Now, technically, last Friday was World Sleep Day, but because sleep is so crucial to our overall well-being, I don't think we need to restrict ourselves to only talking about it on one day of the year. Poor quality sleep impacts not only our alertness and our levels of grumpiness or otherwise, but of course it has profound impact on our mental and physical health. So it's a great pleasure to welcome to the show today doctor and best-selling author Michael Mosley, a qualified medical doctor who has been working for the BBC for decades, producing and presenting a variety of programs around health and human biology, and while also publishing several books around health and diet and exercise. But particularly today I want to flag his latest book called 4 Weeks to Better Sleep, which is being distributed in South Africa now by Jonathan Ball Publishers. As the name suggests, it is a guide on improving the quality of your sleep and looking at some of the habits that might lead to poor sleep, looking at some of the conditions which may affect sleep more chronically, and talking about what we can change in our lives to improve the quality of sleep. Dr. Mosley, it's wonderful to have you joining us on Cape Talk this afternoon. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon to you.
And to you as well. Not your first book on sleep. This is, in fact, an update on your previous work, Faster Sleep. And that suggests to me that perhaps things are moving quite fast and depth is being gained in this field of research more than we might think. Am I right? Is our understanding of what's going on when we sleep progressing that rapidly?
It is indeed. Lots of new studies being done. And indeed, my latest book is actually updated to include a clinical trial I took part in Australia. It was kind of a world first study at a leading sleep center. And we took 30 people who suffered from severe sleep problems, in some cases for decade. And I was one of the participants. Yep. And the ambition was to see whether we could cure them and radically improve their sleep within a 4-week period. And so that is also a backbone of this new book, what we found from that study, because it was really stunning and very, very heartening as well, because we hear a lot about the devastating impacts of poor sleep on mental health as well as physical health. And so it is good to know there are things you can do, however bad your sleep problems.
Now, as you've mentioned, devastating impact on mental and physical health. And we all know what it's like to wake up after a bad night's sleep. You feel unrefreshed, you feel groggy, you feel grumpy. We just don't function at our best. Can you try and just summarize briefly in layman's terms why we feel that way? What processes haven't happened in our bodies and brains if we haven't slept properly?
Sure. So one of the things that happens in your brain is when you go to bed at night and you have deep sleep, that's when you're in your deepest stage of sleep. There are actually chambers in your brain that open up and fluid washes through your brain and it clears out the sort of gunk that's in there. And if you don't get enough deep sleep, then you get a buildup of various proteins, which in turn lead in the long term to things like dementia and Alzheimer's disease. Gosh. And things like that. And we also know that it's only in deep sleep that you get your memories are shifted from short-term to long-term storage. So it's a bit like backing up your computer.
Yeah.
And if you don't do that, then again, the risk is you'll lose those memories and that will have an impact on your overall mental health. And then there's another stage of sleep, which is really important, which is called REM sleep. That's rapid eye movement. If you've ever slept with someone and you see their eyes flickering madly to and fro, that is when they're having their sort of deepest dreams. And it turns out the dreams are actually like a form of psychotherapy. What they're really doing is helping you relive events that happen during the day and reduce stress and anxiety. So REM sleep is particularly important for your mental health. So those are just some of the things going on in your brain. And then sleep also impacts your heart. If you don't get good sleep, you also get hungry, so you eat more.
Yeah.
I was involved in a study, and just one night of poor sleep, people ate on average 300 calories more than they normally would. And so when you eat more, you put on weight, you get more anxious, and then you sleep worse. So you're in a vicious cycle. So it's how you break into that cycle, which I think is really important.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that how in a moment. But interesting comment I saw you make quite early on in the book, the point that a lot of people don't even realize that they're not getting optimal sleep. So maybe we should start with the very obvious question of what normal sleep or good sleep actually looks like. I know it's not the same number of hours for everybody. We're all wired somewhat differently. But what should we be experiencing, or what are the signs that we are getting sufficient quantity and quality of sleep?
The best measure is, do you feel refreshed? When you wake up in the morning, do you actually feel like you had a good night's sleep? And during the day, do you feel sleepy? In the evening, do you fall asleep in front of the television? If you go out to see a film, do you fall asleep then? Do you fall asleep if you go and have meet friends? I saw a guy the other day who was asleep at the wheel of his car. Oh. He was stopped at the red traffic lights, had slumped on the wheel, and he was asleep. And we know that road traffic accidents, you know, commonly caused by people falling asleep and then the car just keeps driving on.
Yeah.
So yes, if you feel pretty dire during the day, then that's a remarkably good test. There is another test you can do, which is you go to bed in the afternoon, you set your alarm for 10 minutes, and does the alarm wake you up? Because you sort of imagine going to sleep quickly is yeah. good, but it's actually a sign that you are sleep deprived. So if you can fall asleep within 10 minutes of going to bed in the afternoon, then that is a sign that you're not getting enough sleep. That's more. These are more accurate measures than simply the hours. Although typically, you know, most adults need somewhere between 7 to 8 hours sleep, and teenagers and younger children need more.
The teens seem to have an insatiable appetite for sleep. And of course, that's a lot to do with the huge processes going on in their bodies and brains as they go through that surge of development. I know a lot of parents worry about it. They worry about a teenager who sleeps late into the morning for on a weekend, for example. Is it something to be worried about, or should we just accept that that is a normal part of an age-appropriate phase, if you put it that way?
It is actually a normal part, and it seems to be that when you enter the teenage years, you become more of an owl. There are hormonal changes. So most young children, they go to bed early, they get up early. But when you become a teenager, you shift. So you're probably not keen on going to sleep much before midnight. You're watching social media and you're really difficult to get up in the morning. Now, an anthropologist told me this is probably because when we were hunter-gatherers, it was important that someone was awake in the middle of the night in order to keep the tribe safe. And that task was allocated by nature to the teenagers. So one way, if you've got a grumpy teenager in the morning and they struggle to get up, is to encourage them to go outside, because the bright early morning light will help reset their internal clock and help to compensate for some of those hormonal changes. But do go easy on teenagers. It's not their fault.
Thank you for that reassurance, as the mother of one still in the house. Michael, you mentioned there light being important, and I know a lot of people currently worry about and talk about blue light being a factor, that you shouldn't have cell phones near the bed or other devices that emit blue light because it's likely to disturb your sleep. I gather from the book that you don't buy into that theory very strongly.
I don't buy into it at all, I have to say. I think having a mobile phone by your bed, or indeed, you know, a laptop, is bad for you, but not because of the blue light, but simply because it's incredibly distracting. I spoke to the guy who actually first discovered, a professor at Oxford University, the receptors in the eye that respond to blue light.
Yeah.
And he said it's absolute nonsense. He said the levels of light you're exposed to by your phone are not even, you know, by a fraction, large enough to have an impact on your brain, that it's just the fact that you're being distracted. So if you think you can get a smartphone, you can put a nice little screen which will screen out the blue light, and it's not going to have and that's going to help, it's not going to help. No. He said that was an utter myth, and there have been quite a few studies which have suggested the same. I think it's basically encouraged by the people who manufacture the screens. It is a good idea not to have your phone by the bed, because otherwise you're going to be, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning, you're going to be on it. And indeed, I found that if you look at Google Trends, the time of day when the word insomnia is most frequently searched for is at 3 a.m. So
there are
people in bed at 3 a.m., wide awake on their phones, looking up insomnia.
And that, of course, is a vicious cycle, because the more you worry about the fact that you're still awake at 4 in the morning, the worse, the harder it gets to fall asleep again. I mean, let's talk a little bit about the proposals that do work. So if you said screening out blue light, not really going to make a difference, this book is all about strategies that can help and helping to establish a sleep schedule, a sleep pattern reliably. And I say that knowing that at least some of our listeners today probably struggle with the ability to have a reliable sleep pattern, because shift work is a thing, and working multiple jobs is a thing. But in a perfect world, I know that the science tells us that predictability and a regular routine is an important part of sleep hygiene. Michael, obviously you can't share the whole book in 5 minutes, but do you want to give us a couple of insights into what that four-week sleep schedule looks like and what you're looking to sort of train the body into in that process?
Sure. I also write about shift work and how you can mitigate some of the worst effects of shift work because, my wife has been a shift worker for many years as a doctor and one of my sons is a doctor. Fortunately, I'm now more in journalism. But I think the first thing you want to do is work out why you're having sleep problems. It could be that you actually have sleep apnea. That's the one where you stop breathing during the night.
Yep.
That's commonly associated with being middle-aged, putting on weight, particularly around the tummy and around the neck. And unless you know you have it and you sort it out, then it doesn't matter what else you do. So we discovered in the study I described in Australia that two-thirds of the people had sleep apnea and didn't know it. It was only when we took them into the lab and measured it, we discovered they'd got it. And so there are apps now, but if your partner is snoring is, but sleep apnea is, you start to keep choking noises because your tongue is falling back and blocking your airways. And if that is your problem, then you do need to go and see a doctor and get it sorted out. There are devices that will help, which I write about, including devices which shift you onto your back because you snore and you get sleep apnea when you're lying on your back. Because as I said, the tongue falls back and blocks your airways. So there are devices which can shift you. One of the simplest is to sew a tennis ball into the back of your pajamas, so that gives you a nudge. But beyond that, there is also something which you can get, a mouth guard called a mandibular advancement device, a MAD. A dentist can tell you about it, but basically it shoves your jaw forward, and because your tongue is attached to your jaw, that stops it falling back. Both of these are very effective. If you have severe sleep apnea, then you want to get something called a CPAP machine. But assuming that's not your problem, say you've got insomnia, then it depends what type of insomnia you have. Some people basically, like your son, I imagine, even if they go to bed quite early, they will struggle to go to sleep. They have onset insomnia. Mm-hmm. And they're the owls. They're people who like to party late and they like to get up late. Bright light for them in the morning seems to be the answer. Conversely, there are people who are more like me. I struggle to remain, cheerful and chirpy late at night. And I'm a lark. I like to get up early. And I benefit from actually having bright light last thing at night. Okay. So I expose myself to bright light at 11 o'clock at night because that way that resets my internal clock. And then if I'm awake at 3 a.m, there are slow, deep breathing exercises, which are really beneficial. But the other thing is that if you're awake at 3 a.m, don't lie there and angst or worry about stuff. Get out of bed, find a cool, quiet corner where you can read a book or listen to music. Because what you're really trying to do is retrain your brain to associate being in bed with sleep and sex and nothing else. And so if you've got lots of entertainment in the room, you're telling your brain this is a time to party, not a time to sleep. If you are lying awake, agonizing about the fact you're not sleeping, again, you're making your brain fear the bed. What you got to do is just retrain it to associate it with sleep and sex and nothing else. And one of the other techniques, which is quite counterintuitive but unbelievably effective, is actually something called bedtime restriction therapy, where you cut down the number of hours you spend in bed. So when I did it, I'd go to bed at 11 and I'd get up at 5 every morning. So I was only in bed for 6 hours. I had quite bad insomnia and this cured it within 4 weeks. So there what you're doing is you're building up your sleep drive so that when you go to bed, you almost immediately fall asleep and you stay asleep because you're tired. And what you're doing is retraining your brain that, as I said, bed is for sleep. And then when you've broken the curse, you can start to gradually increase the amount of time you're spending in bed until you reach a happy equilibrium. And that should happen within 4 or 5 weeks. And this is, without a doubt, the best known way to cure insomnia.
It sounds so sort of counterintuitive that by restricting your sleep, you're going to improve your ability to sleep. But it's fascinating to hear the explanation behind it. And obviously, if you get hold of a copy of the book, you can read more about how to put that into motion. So we're getting so many comments on our WhatsApp line from people who are struggling. And you know, the reasons why they're struggling to sleep range from shifting shift work to somebody who's got some broken ribs and is in pain, which is keeping him from sleeping. I mean, there are many different reasons why some of us may battle to sleep. Can this routine help almost anyone, do you think?
I think so. I mean, obviously, if you have problems with your ribs, or perhaps you have rheumatoid arthritis, or you're in pain, then the first thing you have to try and deal with is the pain,
yeah.
Pain relief or whatever it might be. Because, and as I said, if you have sleep apnea, this isn't an appropriate treatment. So it depends on what your cause is.
Yeah.
For shift workers, I write a lot in the book about shift workers and how to help them, because they have their own particular issues to deal with. But if your problem essentially is you have some form of insomnia, you find it difficult to go to sleep or stay asleep, or most typically of all, you wake up at 3 a.m. and struggle to get back to sleep, then this will really help you. But I do address all those other problems as well. So there are multiple reasons why people struggle with their sleep, but I do think there are some pretty simple solutions as well.
And thank you so much for sharing some insight into those today. Dr. Michael Mosley, great to have you on the show this afternoon.
Thank you.
The book is called 4 Weeks to Better Sleep. And by the way, the impact of food on sleep is something very, very important in this book. It even goes so far as to include recipes that might be of assistance in shifting your diet to a more sleep-friendly diet. Can you believe it? There is plenty to say about menopause and sleep. So for those who are struggling from a hormonal perspective, there is a lot of insight there as well. If you are somebody who is struggling with either the quantity or the quality of your sleep, or who would simply like to know more about the science behind what is happening in our brains and in our bodies when we are at sleep, I would recommend looking for a copy of 4 Weeks to Better Sleep by Dr. Michael Mosley.